Today's class, we're going to go over the whole Vinaya Sutra in 1 hour. Now, I thought you'd like to see, I was always curious to know how much I didn't know about Vinaya. So, I was reading a commentary to get ready for this course. And that's the commentary by Chöné Dakpa Shedrup, Chöné Lama. Sometimes he's just called Chöné Lama, which is like saying Kansas Lama. Okay, Chöné is a little place in Amdo, like Kansas, and sometimes he's just called Chöné Lama. But he undertook in 150 folios to explain the whole Vinaya Sutra, like 16,000 pages down to, you know, the whole Vinaya Sutra is not that long, but the whole subject of Vinaya he abbreviated into a very short work, relatively short work. So I thought you might like to just get a whole. I mean, to me it was very interesting to get a whole grasp of the whole Vinaya. And we can't fill it all in tonight, that's not the point. So I'm not trying to teach you the subject of Vinaya so much tonight as the scope of Vinaya. So you just see from the beginning to the end where it goes. And we'll go as deep into the outline as we can. Tibetans love to outline texts, and he does it that way. And I'll just start. And we'll see how far we get. But I thought, you know, in 1 hour, 1.5 hours, you could get a whole grasp of how far does Vinaya stretch. And then we'll get into more detail on each subject when we cover Jetsun Khapa's commentary, which will start the next class. Alright, so we're going to go over the whole Vinaya Sutra. According to the commentary of Chöné Lama, he'll have a few points that are not covered in the Vinaya Sutra. The first part, he covers in a very, he calls it the preliminary overview. Okay, so you could do like, I'll give you an outline like this. You have it in your reading button. He gives a very preliminary overview. And what he ends up doing is covering the life of Shakyamuni Buddha. He describes, and most of the Vinaya texts describe the process through which the Buddha that came in this world became a Buddha. And it's a long story. It's like three countless eons. How long is a countless eon? I mean, we did that. 10 to the 60th power times 3 times jillions of years. Okay, and it basically outlines the major stages in his spiritual life. You know, how long it took him, over trillions of years of being reborn and experimenting with paths to find the right path and then to follow it properly. And in different texts, it goes through different stages. But basically, you can think of it of him reaching the first Bodhisattva Bhumi and then getting up to the higher levels of the Bodhisattva Bhumis. Bodhisattva Bhumis basically relate to the six perfections. You get on the first Bodhisattva Bhumi when you see emptiness directly for the first time. So this is his whole spiritual life is outlined. Then Chöné Dakpa Shedrup goes through the specific years in which the Buddha did certain things, which is really nice. You know, we know according to the 60-year cycle of animals and elements, like 12 times 5 elements, we know basically exactly the years in which he decided to leave the palace. We know what year he began meditating in the forest. We know what year he gave his first teaching. And they Chöné Dakpa Shedrup goes through each of the events in his life that way. He covers the years in which he gave his teaching. Then he gets into the statement by the Buddha that we covered last time, that if you wanted to get the whole essence of Buddhism, it would be enough just to have the Vinaya scriptures. If you had the teachings on Vinaya, that stands for the teachings of the Buddha. And he explains those quotations and he goes through that. Then Chöné Dakpa Shedrup, which is not very common for Tibetans, goes through all the literature. He explains the whole thing that we did it in a rough way, but he goes through the entire literature. He says, here's the two root texts, here's the four explanatory sutras, and then he goes through all the relevant sutras, and he goes through all the commentaries by ancient Indians, and then he starts to explain a little bit about the Tibetan commentaries. But that's very unusual, and it's nice to have. So that's his whole overview. He gives the whole overview. It's important to know why he spends so much time on Shakyamuni Buddha. You know, what's the point? Is it just that Shakyamuni Buddha taught this Vinaya for the first time? Or why does he spend so much time on Shakyamuni Buddha? And it's very beautiful. He explains that, especially at the beginning of the text, why we mention Shakyamuni Buddha is that the workings of karma, which are called lende, since basically when you're talking about Vinaya, you're talking about good deeds and bad deeds. And this is the subject of karma and its consequences. Le means karma, or the things that you do or say or think. And de means the consequences you get from those things. We're going to spend, I forgot to go over the syllabus with you, but towards the end of the course, we're going to take a reading from Jetsun Kapa's Lamrim Chemo, which is the great Lamrim. The greatest book ever written in Tibetan, probably. And we're going to cut out the section on this subject. Exactly what consequences do you get from keeping or not keeping which vows? And Jetsun Kapa goes through it very beautifully. So basically, there's a connection between what you do, what you say, and what you think, and your whole world. Your whole world is determined by that. If you don't like your office, then blame yourself. If you don't like New York, then blame yourself. You know, if you're not as pretty or as handsome as you would like to be, you got one person to blame. And if you study the correlations between what you do and what you say and what you think and how your world turned out, then it's a great subject. You know, that's very useful for a person to know where everything in their world came from. Because the implication is that you could fix it in the future. You know, you can't change it by wishing it now. You know, like, I can't be handsome by wishing it. But if I know, for example, that leading a moral life might cause that in the future, then I could actually start to affect my future. And if I perfected that process, I could determine my whole future. The whole future world that I lived in would be determined by me quite consciously. But the connection between what you do and what you say and what you think and what's happening to you on a day-to-day level. You know, why did our customer complain to me today and I got in trouble and my boss yelled at me and all this, you know, exactly why? Why did each event happen? You know, why during each 20 minutes of my day today was something screwing up or, you know, what caused it? You know, I mean, it's very curious. You can't control it. I mean, when you get to a certain age, you realize that it's out of your control, basically. You do the right thing, your boss yells at you. You do the wrong thing, they give you a medal and a raise, you know. And you know. So why? Why do these things happen? If you study the connection between karma and consequences, you can understand that. And then you can actually control your future. You know, it doesn't come through willpower. It doesn't come through being intelligent, apparently. It doesn't come through lucky because luck changes. What makes the world run the way it does? It's lende. Okay? That leads us to a subject called the three levels of reality, which you have to know. Yeah. We're trying to bridge between the overview and the text. The text starts with, I mean, after the title, they bow down to who? They bow down to Shakyamuni Buddha. Why? I'm trying to connect you between the overview and the beginning of the text, okay? Which is important. Three levels of reality. First one called Lungyur. Say Lungyur. Lungyur. Lungyur means that level of reality which you can perceive directly, for example, with your senses. Things that you do not need to figure out. Things that you can see right in front of your face. Okay, colors are a good example. Shapes are a good example. Even you can have a direct perception of certain thoughts. Like when you're thinking of something directly and you're not using a process of reasoning. Those things are obvious to you. You could call this obvious reality. Is your obvious reality for everyone else? Example. Let's take colors and shapes. Yeah, I mean if you're blind or colorblind, certain colors are not lungyur for you. So you can already see that these categories are sort of fluid depending on who you are, okay? You know? Like, for most of us, colors and shapes are lungyur. Like, if you had a certain kind of color blindness or something, you could only understand colors and shapes from other people's explanations of them. And then it would be on a different kind of reality for you. It would be some kind of more abstruse reality, some kind of more deep reality. So the second kind of reality we call kokyur. I'll call it deep reality. You could call it just about anything. Abstruse is a very good word, but you don't see it in the New York Times much, so I don't like to use it. Okay. Say kokyur.
Kokyur.
Kokyur. Kokyur means something which is deep enough that for most people it can only be perceived by a process of logical reasoning. Cannot be perceived directly by most people. You would have to think it over to perceive this thing. It's not something you could ever see with your eyes or your ears or your nose or your hands. It's something that is pretty difficult to see, and you could only perceive it normally, under normal circumstances, with some kind of reasoning. An example of a kokyur object for most of us is emptiness. Okay, emptiness is in category number 2 for most of us. At this stage in our lives, at this stage in most people's lives, emptiness would be an object which they only can see right now by thinking about it and by reasoning about it. Okay? By contemplating about it. Could not see it directly. Most people. Okay? Most meaning 99.99999999%. Third category. By the way, if you ever saw emptiness directly, it would change to lungyur. If you had a yogic, what they call yogic direct perception, if you had in deep meditation, it only happens once in countless lifetimes. I mean, the first time only happens after literally countless lifetimes. You would see it directly. Then that emptiness during that 5 minutes would be lungyur to you. When you come out of that meditation, it switches back to kokyur. By the way, if you feel hot, I don't know, what's the best thing to do? Usually this causes a fight. We could turn it on and you won't be able to hear me so well. You could open the windows. I don't know how that'll work. What would you guys like to try? You want to try opening the windows?
Yeah.
Let's try that. Let's just see how it works. Okay. Be careful of the glass things. They fall off. They rotate. I just push them or something like that. We'll try that for a while. I think it might be. Okay, let's see. All right. Shindu Kokyur, the example would be the subtle workings of Lende. Okay? The subtle workings of karma and its consequences. The real connections between what you do, say, or think and what happens to you. A Buddha could explain to you very easily why each bump is on this brick and explain why this is here. You know, I mean, he could go into it. He said 3,000 years ago, you know, you were looking at the wall and you thought something. And that's why this bump is here in the masonry here. I mean, they could explain to you clearly, you know, why does I have this thread on my eyebrow that grows out, you know. And I mean, I always wondered where it came from. I mean, the Buddha could sit there and say, yeah, you know, you made a joke about this guy a million years ago, and that's why that hair is growing out, you know, and stuff like that. I mean, but that kind of thing is called Shindu Kokyur. Shindu Kokyur means extremely deep reality. So the subtle workings of karma and its consequences, you know, you had tens of thousands of distinct thoughts today. Most of mine were like crazy at work, you know, like very busy, very wild, people screaming, you know, everything. People want their checks, stuff like that. And just wild. And I had tens of thousands of thoughts today. Each one of those is going to have its own discrete result. Each one of those will contribute to my future reality. And the reality around you now, with all those millions of different objects, all those cracks in the wall, all those wrinkles on the tankas, everything around you has been created by a different discrete karma. You did something, and that's why you have that peace in your world, that thing. So, for you to really understand where it all came from, you have to understand the subtle workings of karma and its consequences. There's only one being that can perceive Shindu Kokyur. Who do you guess? I mean, Buddha, okay? All right. So if you're going to write a sutra, a book, not a real sutra, right? about Vinaya, how to behave, you know, how to collect good karma, how to avoid bad karma. If you're going to write a book about that, you have to depend on the Buddha. And you have to, mainly, Shinto Kokyur can only be understood by means of studying what has been spoken by an omniscient being. Okay? We cannot see directly the connection between telling a white lie at work and having the taxi driver steal $5 from us or something. I mean, we can't get out of the cab and say, oh, geez, that was 3,400 years ago. Shouldn't have done that, you know. We just don't have that ability. We have to depend on the words of a being who knows these things. And it's only an omniscient being. It's so vast. The interconnections between every single atom in your life and everything that might have ever been done in history by you are so subtle and so vast, only an omniscient being can see them. So when you start out studying the Vinaya, the first thing you do is explain the life history of a guy who got there. And you want to explain how he got there, because that's very relevant. Because it's only by studying what he talks about that you can succeed in keeping your vows, your pratimoksha vows. You're depending on a person who sees all things, because we can't. You know, if it was left up to us, we would never come up with the idea that I didn't get a raise at work, I must have stolen something. You know, the place that I live in New York has bad smells, I must have committed adultery. You know, I mean, those connections just wouldn't occur to us. We don't have the minds to perceive these things. Some very, very good people maybe slightly have an instinct for it. But we have to depend on a person who's omniscient. And then the 16,000 pages of Vinaya, whatever it is, in the canon, are all this guy explaining the connections between what you do, what you say, what you think, and then why your world is the way it is. If you don't like your world, study Vinaya. You know, it's very cool. You can turn it around. Vinaya is not the study, it's not the boring thing of studying all these stupid rules which just restrict your life. It's the science of constructing your future reality. You know, it's working backwards. It's very interesting. You know, I'm not going to get up here and describe 364 nun vows, 253 monks vows, 30-something lay, you know, it's not the point. The point is, figure out what caused each part of your reality and then work backwards and avoid the things that cause the parts that you don't like. Okay, I have to figure out why this customer rejected this order today. That's my job, okay? That's Shinto Kokyur. That's the reason why, at the beginning of all the Vinaya texts, they are bowing down to the Buddha. Because we have to rely on the Buddha. For the study of morality, for the study of ethics, we're not just talking about the effect of lying on your present life. We're talking about the long-term effect on your reality. You have to learn which parts of your reality were created by what kinds of deeds in the past. People are always, I won't say exactly who. People wandering around America telling people, oh, I see your past life, you know, you were a knight in England, you know, and you had this armor, and, you know, and they describe to you your past life, you know. I've actually had students come in this class and say, tell me about my past life, and if you can't, I'm not interested in this class, you know. And Geshe, we had a fortune teller used to wander around our residences in India. We lived in these little rooms, and this fortune teller used to come around and tell everybody's fortune from the palm of their hands, you know. And one day I saw the Geshe who was teaching us, Geshe Nangawandagye. He was peeping at us out the window, you know. So I knew we were going to get some heat the next day. And he gets up the next day in class and he says, you don't need a fortune teller. You don't have to waste your 10 rupees, okay, on a fortune teller who comes and lies to you about your past. You know, if you want to know where this all came from, study Vinaya. I mean, study the vows, study karma and its consequences. You can figure out what your whole life came from. You know, you can see your past life as Kokyur by using reasoning. And these are as good as eyes. You know, reasoning is as good as eyeballs. You know, you can quite clearly figure out who you were and what you were doing mostly. and you can very clearly figure out what's going to happen to you in the future. You don't need a fortune teller for either one. You know, you can tell your own future from exactly from what you're doing now. And by the end of this course, you'll be able to tell exactly what your future is going to be. Whether or not you can change it is a matter of personal willpower. You know, but you're going to learn all the connections. But it takes an omniscient being to lay them out. We have to study it from an omniscient being. Okay, that's the first part. Next he gets on to the actual explanation of the root text. So that's actually number two. The first part is called... So most of the preliminary, most of the overview was devoted to the Buddha, talking about the Buddha. And then he gave a review of all the texts about Vinaya. Now he's going to actually start to explain the text. And the first thing he does is explain the name of the title. Tsengidun means the name of the title, the title. He explains what Vinaya means. He explains what Sutra means. You've already been through that. Okay? You know what Vinaya means. Vinaya controls two things. Vinaya is called Vinaya because you control two things by studying Vinaya. Okay? So we don't have to go through the meaning of the name. Then he goes through, say, Gyurkichat.
Gyurkichat.
Gyura means translation, and chak means a prostration. So at the beginning of almost, at the beginning of any text which was translated from Sanskrit into Tibetan, we start out, normally you have the name of the text in Sanskrit. Then you have the name of the text in Tibetan. And then you have some kind of a prostration. They'll say, I bow down to Manjushri, or I bow down to the Buddha. I bow down to this or that. As we've studied in one of our translation classes, this was a requirement that was set up by some of the early Tibetan kings. When the first translations were done from Sanskrit into Tibetan, the Tibetan king said, let's do a prostration at the beginning. It's a nice, it's a good thing to do. It has a lot of benefits. And then also it helps, they set up rules to identify the subject matter from who you did the prostration to. So like if you're doing a prostration to Manjushri at the beginning of a text, you know the main subject matter is wisdom or emptiness or something like that. In this case, in the Vinaya scriptures, the translator is bowing down to the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, okay? Because he's the person who understands the subtle workings of karma, okay, the subtle connections. The third part of the beginning is, say, Gusong. Chushi. Guso. Chushi. Gu means, in this case, goal. Goal, G-O-A-L. Okay. Sok means etc. Chushi means the 4 points. The 4 points. The 4 dharmas, meaning the 4 points. This is a very common preliminary, or it's a very common opening of almost every Buddhist text. And this involves proving that this text is worth studying. Okay? It's a demonstration that if you study this book, it will be relevant to your own reaching nirvana. It'll be relevant to your stopping your own suffering. Okay? In Buddhism, if a book doesn't have Gusog Chushi, then forget it. Your life is too short to waste time on another kind of book. I mean, in Buddhism, reading a book is not picking it up, staying with it a couple of weeks, you know, after work, drinking tea and enjoying it. It's not like that. I mean, the whole relation to the thing called a book is different. I mean, normally you memorize it first. This is so important, so valuable, so vital for your future. The way you relate to a book is completely different. A book is not a book, it's an experience. You know, it's a whole lifetime's relationship. It's like getting married. When you pick up a book in Buddhism, you're creating a relationship with this thing that's going to enlighten you, and it's not just reading it, it's like experiencing it. You know, you memorize it, you debate it over and over, you read it over and over, you read hundreds of you read dozens of commentaries on it. It becomes like a lifetime companion. The knowledge in that book becomes like a lifetime companion. It's not a book in the way we think of a book, that you just read it and then you put it on the shelf and next year it's not on the bestseller list anymore. You know, a book is an experience. A book is a lifetime intimate relationship that you have with something. And it becomes a lifetime friend. If you study, for example, the Vinaya Sutra well, or say the Abhidhamma Kosha, we spend 10 years on the Abhidhamma Kosha, and it just becomes part of your life. It becomes like a good friend of yours or something. It's not like a book. It's a whole entity with which you're going to spend your life. And you never finish with it. You just get deeper. So Gusō Chūshī means a Buddhist book should have four qualities. I'm not going to go through them tonight. I mean, my object is not to teach you all these subjects. It's just to tell you what the Vinaya Sutra is talking about. But basically, the Gusō Chūshī proves that this book is worth becoming your lifelong companion. It will save you. It will give you nirvana. If you relate to it in the proper way, you can reach nirvana with this book and Buddhahood. It's very beautiful. And basically, a Buddhist who knows the score shouldn't waste your time on anything less. Your mind is precious. It's extremely difficult to get to the point of being a human being who's intelligent, who's getting enough food, who has leisure time to study. And don't waste that real estate on anything less. Don't be satisfied with anything less. I mean, I'm not saying don't read the newspaper, the Sunday Times, because it's bad. I'm not saying that. I'm saying these books can become your lifetime companion and lead you to total happiness. And compared to that, you know, reading the New York Times Sunday, you know, I have a lot of friends who waste the first half of Sunday on the Times. And sometimes the second half too. And part of the week as well. And it's just not worth it. It just can't help you much. I mean, if your brain is fried from work or something, okay, read part of the magazine or something. But then set it down and come to these lifelong friends who can lead you to something holy and an ultimate experience. Reserve your mental real estate for these things because it's very brief. You know, the stage of your life when you can think straight and intelligently is very brief. It will end soon. And you don't have much space. You don't have much time. So fill it up with something that has Gusō Chūshī. If it doesn't have that, don't waste your time with it. Waste a little time, but not much. Then he gets into the actual subject matter, and that has three parts. Say, Domba, Ma Thopa, Thopje. Okay. Domba means vows. Okay. Domba means vows. The word dom is very interesting in Tibetan. It means to tie somebody up, to restrain somebody. And vows are keeping you out of trouble. Okay. We'll talk more about it. I mean, your idea or your conception of vows has to change a little bit. It's almost like the idea of a book. You know, when you really grasp the idea of a holy book in Tibetan, it's like a person that you're marrying. It's going to be a lifetime relationship with this thing, and it's going to affect you deeply. Vows are the same thing. I mean, when I say vows in English, it's like you think of, I don't know what you think of, but I think mostly you think of restriction, or you think of limitation, or something like that. But think of it more as wings or something. You know, these are things which are going to let you fly. You know, these are something beautiful that if you can grow them strong enough, you can fly. You really can fly. I mean, they give you a certain kind of power that you could never have without them. You can do the same things before you take your vows and then do the same things after you take your vows and they change. If you are under vows and do the same good deeds that you used to do good before, the whole experience totally changes. They are not the same thing. It's a completely different experience. If you take vows and then keep them, it's a totally different thing than if you didn't have the vows. So the first subject of the Vinaya, the first study, after you get through all those preliminaries, is Domba Matopa. Matopa means if you don't have them. Thopje means how to get them. Okay? So obviously, the first subject of Vinaya is, if you don't have vows, well then how do you get them? How can you get a hold of these vows? In the Vinaya Sutra, there are four subjects covered here. Obviously, the first one is the rites of ordination. You know, how do you take vows? By the way, it doesn't have to be monk or nun. You can take one-day vows, we'll talk about it. You can take lifetime layman's vows. The first three sets of vows are for people who don't want to commit themselves to robes. And those are beautiful. They're wonderful. Everybody should take them. No obligation. Not too hard, you know, and totally change your life. And that whole process by which you get those vows, you know, what is the proper way in which to take them properly? There's a whole kinds of circumstances. There has to be a certain attitude there. There has to be a certain ceremony there. To receive a vow purely in the lineage of Shakyamuni Buddha, you know, to get really the real thing in the correct way, it's a little tricky. And you have to know how to do it properly. You know, there's all these people going around doing things which are strange and stuff like that. I mean, but to get the pure lineage vows in the proper way so that they actually form in your being properly, and then you really have them, and they have the real effect on you, that's a whole science in itself. And that's the first subject of Vinaya. How to get those vows. What are the ritual? What is the proper ritual? What's the proper attitude that you have to have? Who should be there to give you the vows? Who's qualified to give you vows? What should you be like? This is the first subject of Vinaya. How to get the vows. That's called, the ordination ceremonies are called the earlier and the later ceremonies. Okay? There's earlier ceremonies and later ceremonies. What does that mean? For the first few years of his teaching career, the Buddha ordained people by, like, say, come here, Tuss. And the hair would fall off and the robes would form. You know, he had this power, miracle power. I mean, he could ordain in many different ways. I mean, for the first 5 years or so of the Buddha's career, it was very wild the way he ordained people. You know, it was like, come on. I mean, the way Jesus is going up to the lake and saying, you know, don't be a fisherman, come with me. And that would be ordination in those days. Those were the first ordinations. And that had the full power of ordination. For example, if you perceive certain objects, you are automatically ordained. These are deep things. Later on, after, you know, 5 or 6 years, it became formal. And there began to be a ceremony. And the monks would say certain things, and you would think certain things, and then you would get the ordination. And that is what has come up to the present time. Those ordination ceremonies have come up to the present time. We have lost some of them. Some of them have been broken. The lineage is broken. We cannot, for example, we cannot ordain a full nun anymore in the Tibetan tradition. It was broken during the reign of a certain king, and there were not enough nuns and monks. He wiped out most of the monks and nuns in Tibet at that time. And it got so few. It takes a lot more nuns to ordain a nun than monks to ordain a monk. And it's very difficult to ordain a full nun. And the lineage broke. We don't have the lineage in Tibet anymore. So, for example, that lineage has broken. The ordination ceremony has to be carried out in a certain way by certain people. And it requires a certain quorum of qualified people. And that whole subject is the first subject of the Vinaya Sutra. Okay. After that, they get in. I'm just naming some of the subjects under here. There's a study about, say, Kemble? Lopan. Kemble? Lopan. Okay. Kemble is a word that I'm just putting up here because I want you to know about it. Kemble has come to mean, in modern Tibet, especially in Gelupa monasteries, the abbot of the monastery. So they say the Kemble. Who's the Kemble? The word for X is Sur. So what's a Kensur? It's an ex-abbot. So Rinpoche out in New Jersey, technically he's Kensur of Sera Monastery. He's Kembo of Rashi Genpo Ling Little Mongolian Temple. All four of us monks there. And that's why we call him Ken Rinpoche. So Ken Rinpoche means precious abbot, precious Kembo. In some traditions, Kembo means like Geshe. Kembo has come to mean, in other traditions, a person who has passed a certain course of study, and then they're called Kembo. But in the Vinaya, it has a totally different meaning. Okay? And a Kembo is the person who grants the vows. That's the what do you call it? There's some French word for the main guy. There's some cool word. What is it? He's the master of ceremonies. I mean, he runs the show. Okay? He runs the show at an ordination. That's the Kembo. There's many different forms of Kembos. The qualifications of a Kembo are very strict and very complicated. You know, he has to have rather extraordinary qualities and rather extraordinary personal history as a monk. You know, it's very difficult to be a proper Kembo in an ordination ceremony. So Kembo, if somebody says to you, what's Kembo mean? You have to say, you're talking Vinaya, or you're talking monastery, or are you talking Kagyu? You know what I mean? You have to ask. You know, and then they say, oh, he knows Buddhism, okay? Lopan, in the Sanskrit, it's called Acharya. It has come to mean in India anyone who's good at something, like an archery lopan is an archery master. So it means like a master, a tea ceremony lopan. But in the Vinaya, lopan has a different meaning. In the Vinaya, lopan means the monks who take other important roles during the ordination ceremony. You know, there has to be certain kinds of monks there. They have to have certain qualities. They have to perform certain important functions or roles during the ordination ceremony. So the next subject in the Vinaya under this category is who can be a Kembo? What are the Kembos? How many Kembos are there? You know, what's your relationship to your Kembo later on? What's your relationship to your Lopans? There's many kinds of Lopans during the ceremony. What is their job? What are they doing? What is each one supposed to be? What kind of qualifications do they have to have? This is the whole thing of creating pure vows in the mental stream of a new person. You know, and it's a very difficult, and we have the pure lineage has come down to the present. You know, if we study these things nicely, we can keep it going. 2,500 years, these ceremonies have been strictly performed, strictly watched. All the attitude is there. The monks are pure enough. Everything is right. And the person gets their vows. Very important. You know, how do you create this thing called, we're going to talk about it next class. How do you form that thing called a vow within another person's heart? You know, do you inject it? Or, you know, I mean, how do you get this invisible thing to form within a person? And it's very cool how it's done. It's very nice. It's very pure. Very interesting how by this process, you actually create this new thing within a person called vows. It's very beautiful. Okay, next. Next, they cover the different types of vows very briefly. There are 8 different sets of vows that you can take in the Vinaya. Okay? And we'll be going through that in detail, but that's the next subject in the Vinaya Sutra. So I'm just showing you the topics. I'm not trying to explain the whole Vinaya Sutra because we don't have 15 years. Okay. Next, Shoni Dakpa Sherup and the Vinaya Sutra goes into the measurement of time. How do we measure the years? How do we measure months? How do we measure days? What's the point of spending page after page on the proper measurement of months and days? In the Vinaya, it's very important to time your ordination. At the end of the ordination, one of the last things in the ritual is that the Kembo has to figure out exactly what month, date, and moment it is. And then they say, you were ordained on the 4th month, during the rising of the moon, during the waxing of the moon, in the 4th day, at exactly 6 hours and 13 minutes after noon. You know, and that's it. Your ordination is timed. It's a very important thing in the Vinaya. Why? Well, for one thing, it creates seniority levels. Like, even if a person's much younger than me, if he was ordained before me, then there are all these, there's all this protocol within the monastery. You know, technically, if he has taken his full monk's ordination before me, then there's all this protocol that takes place. And it's much more strict in different countries. But forever after, you have to respect this person in a different way. And so it's very important to time the ordination that way. That's also true of your bodhisattva vows, although most people ignore it. Okay? You shouldn't ignore it. It's very important. Okay, but that's a long story. Okay, it's one of your vows, by the way. Okay, second major subject, and then we'll probably take a break shortly after that. I say that to keep you awake. Mm-hmm. Say topa, minyamba. Topa, minyamba. If I tell you that the first section of the Vinaya Sutras, or the Vinaya Scriptures, is always how to get the vows if you didn't have the vows, what do you guess the second subject is? Yeah, okay, how to keep your vows. Topa means after you've gotten vows, Minyamba means how to keep them from being damaged. There's this concept in the Vinaya of your vowels getting damaged. There's four main parts here, and I'll just put them in English. And this subject centers around, by the way, this is outer support to keep the vowels. There are going to be four sections here. The first one is, you've got some kind of outward support, someone outside of you to help you keep your vowels. And that's called a ne lama. Yeah. Yeah. Say ne,
ne
lama.
Lama.
Ne lama.
Ne lama.
Okay. Ne means like resident. Lama means lama. Teacher. Spiritual guide. Okay. I've translated it in your outline as a preceptor. Monastic preceptor. Oh, did I say preceptor? Yeah. Meaning a person who guides you, who guides a young monk. A Ne Lama you're supposed to keep for a minimum of 10 years. In other words, for 10 years, for the first 10 years of your ordination, you are under the strict guidance of an older monk. And that's a Ne Lama. That's your Ne Lama. It doesn't have to be your spiritual teacher. It doesn't have to be your scripture teacher. It may not be your root lama, but it's the older monk who has agreed to take you on. And for 10 years, I mean, if you keep the Vinaya strictly, the only things you can do without consulting him or her is brush your teeth and go to the bathroom. That too. It's very strict. For 10 years, you're under the very strict guidance of a private monastic preceptor, male or female, depending on, you know, if you're a monk or a nun. Yeah.
Ordination.
But with the require, by the way, the requirements for Ne Lama are the next subject of Vinaya Sutra, and they are extensive. I mean, I think there's 105 qualities, and they're very difficult to fulfill. I mean, this person has to be really extraordinary. This person has to be, you know, very wise, very well trained, very pure. There's a whole, I mean, the list is 105 items long. It's very difficult to be a real Ne Lama. You know, it requires a very high degree of purity as a monk to be a Ne Lama. And then your relationship to that Ne Lama is very strict. After 10 years, you gain some kind of ability to act on your own more frequently. And that's the, in the monastic system, that's called a Ne Lama.
Okay.
In this section, they also go through the ordination, some of the ordination details, referring to the students, what the students should be like. And then they talk some, even in the Vinaya Sutra, about the ordination of nuns. So they do cover that in this section in the Vinaya Sutra. This is called the inner support. It's called Sampannamdak. We talked about it when we had the course on the Bodhisattva vows. Basically, this is keeping in mind throughout your life why you took your vows. You know, try to remember the attitude you had when you walked in that room. I still remember, you know, the ceremonies when I took my lay vows and then when I took my monk's vows. I mean, you remember forever sitting in front of this person and swearing to keep these vows. And that's called the inner support. I mean, the remembering the reason why you took your vows, remembering the state of mind you were in when you knelt before that person and swore never to break these things is very powerful. And that, you know, there's certain things that an outside person can help you to do to keep your vows. But on the inside, you have to have these, you have to keep some kind of awareness of the intentions with which you took your vows. Ideally, perfectly, during the ordination ceremony, you must, at least once, cross your mind that this life is suffering and that there's nothing good about this life as it stands now. And during that ceremony, at some point, there must be some realization that I'm taking these vows to get out of this. You know, I'm taking these vows to get to nirvana. And that's why I'm here. That's why I'm taking these vows. Ideally, it must be during the ceremony that, even if just for a short time, that crosses your mind. You must have that in mind for the vows to form. And throughout your life, until you die, because pratimoksha vows finish when you die. You lose them when you die. Not like bodhisattva vows. Bodhisattva vows stay in your mental stream even after death. Pratimoksha vows, the Vinaya vows, they disappear when you die. Okay, so, but from the moment you take them to the moment you die, you have to keep reminding yourself of why you took them. And that, just thinking about why you took them, if you took them for the right reasons, will help you keep them. This is called Mithun Chok. Say Mithun
Chok.
Mithun Chok. Obviously, one of the best ways to keep your vows from being damaged is to know them. And, you know, I was out in California, I was teaching the Bodhisattva vows, and 64 vows, and some of those people have been there 20, 25 years. They did not know their vows. You know, they didn't know what they had vowed. And they do it every couple of years, you know, they take these vows every couple of years. But the best way to keep them is to know what they are. Okay? I mean, it seems like pretty simple. But many, I would say 90% of Americans who take Bodhisattva vows have no clue what most of them are. And one of the most important things, obviously, one of the most important ways to keep your vows is to very, very clearly understand what you agreed to do and what would be breaking them and what's not breaking them. You know, you have to study that. That's a very important study. Okay? That's, as you can guess, is the major part of Vinaya Sutra. You know, is the study of, well, what the heck are the vows? You know, when do I break them? When do I not break them? When can I stretch them? When can I not stretch them? You know, which ones are forever for all situations? Which can be, which must be modified in certain situations? And that's the whole study of the vows. Inside here, in the Vinaya Sutra, you get five different classes of vows. Okay? You study, at this point, they're beginning to talk mainly about monk's vows. And inside the monk's vows, it's 253 vows. And there are five groups of vows. They range from extremely serious to very serious to medium serious to, you know, and then there's 112 lighter ones, you know. Four very, very grave ones. And then you have to study all five groups. And that is the main subject of the Vinaya Sutra. That whole part, you won't hear from me. I can't teach that to you, okay? All I can do is say there's five groups of vows. It's 253 vows, ranging from extremely serious to pretty light, very light, you know. And that is obviously a big chunk of the Vinaya Sutra. We won't even go into that. Let's see if he says anything else. Inside there also, he explains how you can lose your vows, okay? And we will cover that also, okay? In here, about understanding what works against your vows is the study of, well, how do you lose pratimoksha vows? How do you lose the vows that we're talking about here? Okay, what can make you lose those vows? And it's pretty interesting. And Chötsön Kapa is going to cover it. Okay. They then, by the way, they also then get into ethical conundrums. What is that? How you pronounce? Yeah. You know, like, if you're supposed to do that, but you're not allowed to do that, but you have to do that, you know, what are you supposed to do? You know, and that's a big part of the Vinaya Sutra, you know. What are you supposed to do when two vows have conflicting demands on you? You know, and if you take Bodhisattva vows, and then you go ahead and take the secret vows, this becomes a very important subject. Because sometimes it's the study of prioritization. You know, which vow takes priority over which other vow? And it's a very difficult subject. It takes a lot of study. You have to study that very carefully. Also, in that general category of things, there's a thing called Dordu. Dordu means it's a subject in the Vinaya where, given a whole different culture, you know, if Buddhism reaches a new country, if Buddhism has reached a new culture, then under what circumstances can we do something different and still be keeping our pratimoksha vows? This is a whole study within the Vinaya Sutra. And it's a very, obviously for us, because we're involved in the transition of Buddhism from Asia to the West, it's very important to know the ground rules for when you can adjust things for different situations. And that whole study is called Dordu. And that's another section here. Then finally they get into extenuating circumstances like if a monk goes crazy, and he does something bad, did he break his vows? Did he lose his vows? What happened? You know what I mean? What about extenuating circumstances like, and then they actually get into this question of temporary insanity and things like that. You know, if the person accidentally takes a drug or something and does something wild, well then have they broken that vow or not, and what's going to be the result of that? Okay. The last section here, and then we'll take a break. There's a thing called shi in Sanskrit, vastu. There are 17 shi. Shi means like a monastic practice. There are 17 monastic practices. They can also be divided into 100 or something rites of monasticism. But basically, the most important ones are three, and those I can tell you, but I can't describe them much. Okay. First one is sojong. Sojong means the practice of the monks meeting together twice a month to do a ritual of purification and confession. Okay. Twice a month, all the monks and nuns must meet together, and then we have a ritual by which we purify anything wrong we might have done. Okay. That's called sojong. Okay. S-O-J-O-N-G. Sojong. Like a lot of our classes are going to be canceled due to sojong, okay? As you may have noticed. And it's on the lunar calendar. You know, it depends on the... It's according to the position of the moon at a certain time, so that all over India, all the monks were doing sojong on the same night. Monks and nuns. It's done together with the monks and nuns. That's sojong. The next shi of the top three is called yarne. Say yarne.
Yarne.
Yarne. Yarne means... There was a custom in India of undertaking a retreat that all the members of the Sangha, each year in the summer, yar means summer, should do a summer retreat together. Normally it was 3 months long. And it was a very strict thing of... in fact, our yarne started 2 days ago. Normally you would say, I'm not going out of this block for the next 3 months. And there's a whole ritual where they give you a bed, and they give you a mat, and they choose someone to cook the food for 3 months, and then you all agree to stay quietly and to study Vinaya, to study the scriptures, and to meditate for 3 months. So that's yarne. That's the second of the great three shi. There's 17 total, but I'm talking top three. The next one is called gagye. Say gagye. Gagye is the release of the summer retreat. After 3 months, the summer retreat lets out. In the monastery, nowadays, it's a time for celebration and goofing off. And it's a great custom. It's a very good custom because you've been, you know, working very hard, you've been studying very hard for 3 months, you've been restricted for 3 months, and during Gaye, everything is, I mean, you can't do anything bad, but you can listen to radio, you can go to movies, you can play games, you know, things like that. The whole monastery loosens up. You know, there's no classes, there's no debating, there's no anything. Everyone just relaxes and enjoys themselves after this time of intense study and meditation. And then it's very nice to feel the... And you even see the Kembo, meaning abbot, playing games with the little kids, and, you know, they play pool and stuff, and karam, and things like that. I mean, it's a very nice custom where the whole place lets up. And I think it's necessary sometimes. Speaking of which, veggie, sushi, and kung fu extravaganza. You all know about that, right? You got that blurb already. I'm supposed to announce it again. Saturday 5 to 12, 141 East 3rd Street. Somebody will write it on the board. It's a fundraiser. You have to pay $20. You get to eat sushi all night and watch kung fu movies. That's Gaye, American Gaye. Oh, in the monastery it's about 2-3 weeks, something like that. And then they go back to really hard study. They work very hard in the monastery. I mean, the day in the monastery is like 18 hours long, and it's very difficult. So Gaye is like a well-deserved rest. And it's important. In Buddhism, it's recognized that there's a time and a place for resting and relaxing. And that's the other one. Finally, they talk about the proper ways to do sojong. And also there's not only restoring your vows if you happen to damage your vows, But there's a whole section in the Vinaya Sutra at this point of how to restore unity inside the monastery in case of a split, in case of some problems. I mean, the reason people go to a monastery is that they're not perfect. And the purpose of a monastery, and the purpose of taking these vows, is to improve yourself. But by definition, if you're a Buddhist, and by definition, if you are sitting in this world, in samsara, you're not perfect already. Because you didn't reach nirvana, you have mental afflictions. By definition, that's the definition. So people are in a monastery in order to reach some kind of nirvana, but by definition, if they haven't reached it yet, they have mental afflictions. And even in the Buddha's time, quarrels between the different people in that sangha, fights, splits, different kinds of disagreements, very common. I mean, if you get to the point where you can read the sutras well, a lot of them were start out by the Buddha saying, you guys have been quarreling with each other a lot nowadays, so I'm going to tell you a story. And then he'll go into this long story about this guy who was a bodhisattva and someone else criticized him for what was apparently wrong behavior, and then it turned out to be pure behavior, so the guy who criticized him ended up in hell for 50,000 lives. And then the Buddha, this is an actual story, and then the Buddha at the end will say, and the guy who did the criticizing was me, so I know. So I'm telling you, don't quarrel with each other, you know. So the last part of this section in the Vinaya Sutra is, how do you bring the monks back together if there's been some problem? You know, how do you keep the monks, how do you keep the unity among the Sangha? Because there will always be problems in any Dharma group, in any group of more than one person, and even sometimes in a group of one person, you know, you have problems because we live on mental afflictions. And in groups it gets worse. So this is a whole study, and it's recognized as an important part of the Vinaya. You know, how do you keep a group together when all of us are crazy? You know, and that's a whole study. And then how do you patch things up when things go bad? And that's a whole study of Vinaya. Take a break, come back in about 10 minutes. We got a little bit to go, not much. I don't think I made it clear that we just went over the third part, the third major part. First one was getting vows. Second one was keeping them from getting damaged. And the third one would be, if they are damaged, how to fix them. Okay. And that's where we get into the sojong ceremony, and that's where we get into the restoration rituals, or the rituals for bringing the Sangha back together, to restoring unity. So there's really two subjects there. You know, how to do your confessions and your purifications. If you do mess up, which is assumed we will. I mean, the purpose of taking vows is to control behavior which otherwise we normally do. So it's very likely that you're going to be breaking them to some extent, that you're going to be damaging them to some extent. So the whole concept of how to do a good purification and how to restore your vows is very important. And that's a whole subject of the Vinaya Sutra, very important subject. And then how to patch up things if there's fights within the group or quarrels within the group, things like that. The next section in the outline, which we're going to hand out at the end, is called ancillary points. You know, it's like other stuff to know. And in there they get into, for example, the construction of a monastery. You know, what should be in the monastery? How should the walls be? What kind of foundation should it have? How far away from the nearest lay people does it have to be? 500 yangtraks, by the way. And things like that, details like that. Inside there is what I consider to be one of the most important subjects of the Vinaya Sutra, which is how to draw the required painting in the foyer of your temple. And what is that painting? It's a Wheel of Life painting that we have here at the foot of the steps. And I love that. I love that. Here it is, the last part of Vinaya Sutra. One of the last subjects is, by the way, when you finish the temple, don't forget to draw the Wheel of Life at the door. You know, everybody should see it as they come in. If you study the painting of the Wheel of Life, there are two stories of how it first was painted. It was painted on two occasions by the Buddha. It was designed by the Buddha himself to talk about samsara and nirvana. And one of the most famous, I mean, one of the events was that one of his disciples, when he became a monk, he was still attached to his former wife and to his former pleasures. So the Buddha decided it would be a good exercise to take him to hell and show him what it was like. You know, and then he would get renunciation and he'd want to be a monk. And he did. It's like Dante. It's very similar to Dante. I mean, it's eerily similar to Dante. I mean, the experiences that he goes through, what he sees there, what the Buddha shows him. According to the Abhidharma, a person with certain powers can take another person to these realms. You know, and he did. And when he got back, and the guy was, you know, shaken up, and he said, "Now I want you to draw what you saw. And we'll put it at the door of every temple." Okay. So I thought we'll go through. I would like to go through. There are about 7 components of that painting that the Vinaya Sutra says you must have. It tells you how to draw the painting. And we'll go through those 7 real quick. By the way, the quotation, the opening line of this section is. I'm going to write that because it's on your homework. You don't have to do it in Tibetan, but it's good just to say it, okay? It's just a blessing to say the words of it. Say, Gokang, Du, Korwe, Kolo'o, Changapar, Chao. Okay, Gokang Du means at the foyer, in the foyer. Gokang means place where the door is, okay? At the entrance to the temple. Gokang Du. This korwe means of samsara. Okay? The circle of suffering life. Suffering life. Korwa. And then korlo means the wheel. Nowadays that wheel is called what? Do you know the Tibetan word? Sipe korlo. Sipe korlo. Sipe korlo means it's another word for samsara. I think they changed the name because korwe korlo, they probably got confused, you know? Because this korwa means the circle of suffering life. And this korlo means circle. So it's like the circle of the circle, and people probably got confused, so they later on they called it sipe korlo. Same thing. Exactly the same thing. So what it is, and o is like an instruction. It's like an ending. This is how the Vinaya Sutta reads. It's like, build the temple. Put the painting. Make it 5 parts. You know, the whole thing reads like that. The original sutra. So this is Gokang Du, Kolo'o, you know, put that painting of the wheel of life, of the wheel of suffering life, in the foyer. Okay, and then it says, Cha ngapa chao. Cha means part. Ngapa means 5. Chao means make it. Okay, make it 5 parts. Give it 5 parts. That's the opening line. And now we're going to go through the 7 components of the wheel, and then we're done for tonight. Okay, this is. I thought you would like it because this is the proscription of the Buddha. You know, this is the way the wheel was originally drawn. Okay, and I think it's good to know. The study of the 12 links around the wheel is a part of the study of the perfection of wisdom, which comes in the monastery when you study Majjhimika. You know, we're not going to get to that tonight. That's a very deep subject. I think we could devote a whole course to it, actually. We did it up in Boston. It took 3 days. So we're not going to go through the meaning of the wheel. We're going to go through what did the Buddha say had to be in the wheel. Okay? 7 parts. First one is, he said, Changa. Changa Pachao. Okay, first thing you need in the wheel is the main wheel. You know, it's that part, by the way, it's that part here. I didn't do it right, but it's this part from here to here. And this represents what? The 5 parts are? It's the 5 realms of existence. Okay? It's the 5 types of beings. It's the 5 choices after you die. You're going to go to one of them. Unless you work really hard in this life. Unless you become the summa cum laude graduate of ACI who finishes all his or her tantric practices and gets out of it in this life. Okay? Something like that. Which is the goal. If you don't make it, you've got to stay in one of these 5. You don't have any choice. You will end up in one of these 5. Here there's what I call pleasure beings. which at least, I'm not sure exactly, you got to check it out, but you could divide it into better realms and lower realms, okay? In the better realms, you've got two. In the lower realms, you have three, okay? I'm not necessarily putting them in the right location. I don't remember, actually. But pleasure beings up there, which is a temporary heavenly state, and after that, you usually go down. And then human beings. And then down here you have hell realms, and then what we call they're called hungry ghosts or craving spirits, and then animals. So traditionally the painting should have five parts here. A lot of the paintings nowadays have six, and if you look at the one at the foot of the stairs, it has six. That's because they broke off in the pleasure beings the lesser pleasure beings. There's full pleasure beings and lesser pleasure beings. And they split them off and they made six, which is okay. But traditionally, the instruction were chang apa jao, make it five parts. So the first component of the wheel is those five parts. Second component, say pardoa.
Pardoa.
Also you can say dzuke. Say dzuke. The instructions only say dzuke. Okay, they don't say pardoa. So I want you to know that. It says dzuteke wa semjen, so chung gyuma shindu chipo wa dan kewa da kyango, which means Zutekewe Semchen means those beings who are born miraculously. Miraculously means they just show up there. Like the first human beings on this planet, according to Buddhism, they just appeared. When you're born in hell, you don't have a hell mommy and a hell daddy. You just show up there. I mean, you die here, you go through the bardo, then you take birth in the hell, and in a second, you are there with a whole body and someone's about to smash you with some kind of weapon. And you know, you're just there, suddenly you're just there and somebody's smashing you and killing you. And then your first reaction is to struggle against them, and that your whole career there is spent in this Hades, you know, it's spent in this insanity of people just trying to slaughter each other. So from the very first moment that you're conscious there, you know, you just show up and someone's attacking you already. And that goes on for the whole time you're there. And that's called Dzuke. So Dzuke means a being who's born that way. The classic being that is born that way is a bardo. What's a bardo? I mean, it's some kind of a spirit being between the death and rebirth. Okay. And we went through the whole thing in the last course. The last course was devoted to that. You need to take some kind of birth through which you can reach your next destination. And that's called a bardo. Okay. I wasn't aware of this instruction in the Vinaya. The full instructions say, paint them in a chain to demonstrate that they are swirling around and taking birth again and again in death, death and birth, death and birth, death and birth. And that's where you see, I assume that it's in that inner part of the wheel there. And if you look carefully, there's like these evil spirits dragging people down, and there's these holy spirits bringing them up. And I take it to be that chain of beings here. That's also supported by the fact that bardos are included where in the five realms? Do you remember from the last course? They're not included. So you got to get them in there somewhere. They're in samsara. We got to include everybody in here, right? So I assume that this refers to that inner wheel, because they are circling around, and I guess they are parking in different locations, you know. They are going out and coming out here or coming out here, and that, I've never thought of it that way, but that appears to be the intent of the Vinaya Sutra. Okay. The next instruction is, I'll just put duksum. Say duksum. Duksum. The three poisons of the mind which make us suffer our whole lives. Duk means poison, sum means the three. I think somebody burned a chapati. Duk sum. This is those three animals in the middle of the picture. Okay? You know them. They say hatred, anger, and desire. But you know from our past discussions that we'll start with the snake. The snake is easy. Let's start with where the sutra starts. They say start with the desire. Okay? And desire, normally you think of a rooster in the middle. There's a rooster in this area here. We'd drawn it before, right? Very badly. And that represents desire. I don't like the translation desire so much because it implies, like, you know, something very strong and it only happens once a week or something. It is liking things. It is liking things ignorantly. Okay. Is it wrong to like things? Well, yes and no. Should you like anything in this world? I mean, should you like the fact that you're strong? That's just stupid. You know? The last thing you want to do is get attached to this hunk of meat where the only future is bad. You know, you don't want that kind of liking. Should you like nirvana? Of course. You know, but this is ignorant liking. Okay, this is liking samsaric things that can never make you happy anyway. Okay, it's that emotion of wanting. Second animal is, oh, by the way, in the original text, it doesn't say rooster. It says pigeon, which I never knew. You know, nowadays they draw a rooster, but the original, the early ancient text, they say pigeon, because apparently pigeons had, apparently they have some kind of desirous behavior, okay? And you have a snake, okay? The snake represents disliking things. In other words, these three poisons are not something that comes up in your mind every time you go into a fit of fury every 3 weeks. It's not like that. They are operating continuously in your mind. These three poisons are in your brain constantly. They are acting in you constantly. So I don't like the translation. I don't get angry except when the customers hassle me. But disliking and liking ignorantly, we have it all day long. We live on it. It makes us unhappy. It's our main mental afflictions. We live on that. It's our whole life story, is those three poisons going on in your mind. We have very little vacation from those three. They make us unhappy our whole lives. Most people are unhappy the whole length of their lives, and it's these three poisons cooking there the whole time and just making you miserable. They pull you from one direction to the other. I want this, I don't want that. And your whole life is spent struggling like that. That's the three poisons. So don't think of them as, you know, a Playboy magazine and screaming at somebody. They're more subtle than that. That's the poison that's in your bloodstream your whole life. Okay. Then it says, draw the pig. And the Vinaya Sutra says, be sure to draw the pig, the tail of those two coming out of the pig's mouth. The pig should be eating the other two. Okay. And if you see ancient pictures of the Wheel of Life, that's the way it is. Nowadays, they draw it as the three animals eating each other. But in the very old pictures, you'll see the pig and then the other two animals coming out of his mouth. Why? Yeah, it's because we don't understand emptiness, and we don't understand ethics, and we don't understand the marriage between ethics and emptiness that makes liking and disliking happen. If you understood emptiness well, and if you understood ethics to be the holy sister of emptiness, you wouldn't have the other two. You wouldn't have liking and disliking in the way that we have them now. You would be free. You'd have reached nirvana already. Okay. If you kill the pig, you kill the other two. Okay. Very important. Okay, number four. I'll cheat. I'll put a number. Excuse me? Ignorance. The pig is ignorance. Okay. It's Yenlak, Y-E-N-L-A-K, 12. I cheated. I'm getting tired and I had a rough day. So, Yenlak 12. Okay. These are the 12 links of dependent origination, which are to be drawn around the outside. 12 pictures which describe the mechanism which triggers rebirth. Okay. The mechanism by which we stay in this world. You know, what thing triggers what thing, what triggers what thing, what triggers what thing, what triggers what things. It's this domino thing that once you get it started, you're going to be here forever. They continue to trigger each other in a circle. Okay. You must study the 12 links. It's a long story. We don't have time. But we will do it sometime. And Rinpoche did it very beautiful. He taught it to us very carefully. And it's part of the study of the perfection of wisdom.
Okay.
Asanga went over it. Maitreya taught it very nicely. Mr. Wig. Oh, John. Can you do me a favor? Find me a Sojong book, if anybody has one, in Tibetan. And then I have a painting of the Wheel of Life on my under my bed, I think. Yeah, in Tibetan. If anybody has one. If not, it's okay. Say, this one is important, so I want to make sure you got this one. Say, Tamje, Mitakpa, Nyiki, Sung. Okay, Tamje means the whole thing. Okay, Tamje means the whole thing. Mitakpa Nyiki means by impermanence. Okay, capital I, by impermanence. Sung means in the clutches of. Draw everything in the clutches of impermanence. Okay? And that's where you have what? You have that monster. Okay? That cookie monster. The whole thing is in the grasp of this monster. Okay? You know, I take people to around the temple in New Jersey all the time, and they see this painting and they say, oh, Buddhists believe in these demons and stuff. I said, no. It's always described in the scriptures as the event inside you of death, you know, working since the day you were born. You know, he's biting, 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 chewing, chewing. You know, he's scratching. He's taking out more and more from the inside. He's working his way out from the inside. And he's ripping up your insides. And then sooner or later, he'll reach something vital and you'll die. It'll be called death. This monster is inside. It's the fact of your own impermanence. Okay, they don't believe it's some little guy that jumps out after you die or something like that. It's the own your own impermanence which is killing you day by day, moment by moment, working to kill you from the inside. That's Mitakpa Nyiki, Sungo. Say Dawa.
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 This is very abbreviated, okay, because it's so late. The fourth thing is Tengdu Sangye Nyangen Nei Depe Kingor Kapo Nyewar Tumba O. And that means Tengdu means on top. Okay? Tengdu means, thank you, on top. And Sangye means what? The Buddha. Nyangen De means Nyangde. This is not a real great version, okay? Now you know. This is the Buddha up here. And it says, Kingol kapo nyewar tumba o. He should be pointing to a white heavenly body. Okay? It doesn't specifically say moon. Dawa means moon. But it says he should be pointing to a white heavenly body. Which here is, I guess it's this one. But normally it's a full moon. Normally it's a big white full moon. If you look at the one in the temple down in New Jersey, it's this part is better. And you can see the Buddha pointing. And then the moon, normally there's a big full moon over here. That represents the Buddha showing the way to nirvana. The moon is nirvana, and the Buddha is showing the way. Okay. Why didn't they paint him down here, which some people do nowadays? He ain't in the clutches of impermanence, okay? He's out. He got out. Okay, he's not in there anymore. I mean, some people nowadays, they paint Buddhas around all over the place, teaching, stuff like that. It's considered very inauspicious among those who know about this painting. He should be outside, and he should be showing the way to nirvana. You know, and that's what the original scripture says. By the way, you can see here that it's not... No, here it is painted correctly. Sometimes you see them in a chain, but here it's painted correctly. And then here are the bardo beings. And here you got six instead of five. So they didn't do Chang Apa Jao, okay? They did get the 12 links as it should be. The last instruction, and that's the last thing tonight. The last instruction is, at the bottom of the painting, add the two verses. Okay, add the two verses. It has not been added to this painting. In more traditional paintings, you can see it. I think the one on the cover of the Wheel of Life book has the... You can see the verses down at the bottom. in the right place. And I, since it's late, I'm just going to read it. I'm going to read you the verses, okay? It's two verses of four lines each. It starts out by, and it's good. It's auspicious to say it, okay? Ready? Tsampa cha, shing, yungwa cha, sangye tenla, jukpa cha, dambu kimla, langchen shin, chidak deni, shombar cha, kashi raptu, payu pe, chundul dila, chugyurpa, kewe korwa, rapangne, dungyal tamar, chepargyur. And monks are required to recite that at the end of every sojong. So it says this. Tsampa cha shing yungwa cha means take it up and give it up. Take it up and give it up. What it means is learn the things you should do and learn the things you shouldn't do. Okay? Take up the things you should do, give up the things you shouldn't do. Sangye tenla jupa cha. Enter the teachings of the Buddha. You know, get into the teachings of the Buddha. Dambu kimla langchen shin. Dambu kim is a very difficult word, but what it means is a house made of reeds. You know, those very skinny, weak reeds. A hut made of reeds. Langchen shin means like an elephant. Okay, like a bull in a china shop. Okay, same thing. like an elephant who squashes a little hut made of little sticks. Okay, I mean in India that's a powerful thing. Chidak deni shombarja, destroy the Lord of Death in the same way. Smash the Lord of Death in the same way. Okay. Meaning, if you study this painting and you understand it, then you'll be able to smash death itself. You don't have to die the kind of death that you've seen everyone else die in this world. You are among a very few people who have an option now. If you study these things properly, you don't have to go through that process like that. And that's the point. Okay. Kanshi ratu bayube means anybody who with the proper care, okay, anybody who with the proper care, chundu dila chugyurpa, practices this dharma which is dul. What's dulwa? Vinaya. Okay. Anybody who practices this disciplining dharma, okay, and I obviously it's an allusion to the Vinaya. Okay. Kewe koro rapangne, they will give up they will be able to leave behind the wheel of rebirth. Dungel tamar chepagyur, and they will put an end to their suffering.